Okay. Dr. Corin kicked off our program so beautifully. He'll close our program. Just mention a couple of things I did not mention in the earlier introduction. Dr. Corin received a PhD in philosophy at Columbia University and received smicha from the Israeli Rabbanut. And I don't know how many years you spent in Israel, but I know a number of years you spent.
Not enough.
Yeah, not enough years in Israel. And Dr. Corin is also the founder of an institute in Tinek Davar that meets once a month discussing certain issues, I guess, important issues affecting our community. So, again, it's a pleasure to reintroduce Dr. Eugene Corin.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. It's not the best position to be in. I'm the only thing that stands between you and going home. So I'll try to make it as pleasant as possible. The topic is Jewish-Christian relations. Can the future be better than the past? And that fills me with fear and trembling. Because the Talmud says that after the destruction of Beit She'ni, after the destruction of the Second Temple, prophecy was given over only to children and fools. And obviously I'm not a child, so there's only one other possibility here. And therefore I'm going to hesitate to make any prophecies about the future, but what I'll try to do is to indicate some conditions that could give us hope that the future could be better than the past. And the bottom line really is it depends on us. It's not predetermined. I believe that the future can be better than the past, but it depends upon us in the Jewish community and also, obviously, the Christian community. Before the first Zionist Congress in the year 1897, an article appeared in the official Vatican periodical, Civilita Catholica, explaining that Jews are required to live as servants in exile until the end of days, a fate to be avoided only by conversion to Christianity. So when Theodor Herzl approached Pope Pius X in 1904, he went to the Vatican, he got an audience with the Pope, and he wanted to enlist the Pope's support for the Jewish return to Eretz Yisrael. And here's what the Pope told him. It is not in our power to prevent you from going to Jerusalem, but we will never give you our support. As the head of the church, I cannot give you any other answer. The Jews do not recognize our Lord. Hence, we cannot recognize the Jewish people or the Jewish return to the Holy Land. So when you come to Palestine, we will be there to baptize all of you. In March of the year 2000, Pope John Paul II made an official visit to Israel, the Jewish state. He met with the Jewish state's president and the chief rabbis, and he prayed at the Kotel, and he prayed for the welfare of the Jewish people as his elder brothers, who still remain the people of God's covenant. Clearly, something very fundamental had changed in the Catholic Church and in Christian thinking between the time of Herzl, approximately 100 years ago, and today, at the beginning of the 21st century. In fact, the change didn't begin 100 years ago. It began 60 years ago when the Western world was stunned by what Hitler had done to our people. The final solution almost succeeded right in the middle of Christian Europe. And this caused sensitive Christian thinkers to think anew about Christianity's relationship to Jews and to Judaism. Reflecting on the unimaginable evil of the Shoah became the seed for Christian reappraisal of its tortured history and teachings about Jews. something in Christendom had gone horribly wrong, and Christian thinkers recoiled from what had taken place. And so over the past 60 years, this process of reassessment has led to a whole new discussion that is no less remarkable for its content than for its qualities. And it's vitally important for Jews to understand this. Jews, I would say by and large, are clueless about the fundamental changes that have taken place in official, certainly Catholic thinking, and to some extent, perhaps a lesser extent, in Protestant thinking. But this is very, very fundamental. And it's very impressive. I mean, the Jews have a word for this. Right? It's called tshuva. It's called doing a din v'cheshbon. Right? The Christian thinkers, many of them engaged in very deep introspection about the health and the morality and the incorrectness of traditional Catholic and Christian thinking about teaching about Jews. One Catholic theologian succinctly dubbed the transformation of Christian thinking about Jews as the six R's. Here are the six R's. One, repudiation of anti-Semitism. Two, rejection of the charge of deicide. Three, repentance after the Shoah. Four, recognition of the State of Israel. Five, a review of teaching about Jews and Judaism. And six, a rethinking about the whole issue of proselytizing Jews. Now, judged in light of traditional Christian doctrine, it's not an exaggeration to claim that most Christian theologies have undergone a revolution with respect to their spiritual and historical Jewish patrimony. The Vatican's proclamation of Nostra Aetate, which Dr. Berger referred to earlier today, in 1965, proved to be a point of departure for Christians that will probably be a point of no return. That is, many Christians probably will never go back to Christianity as it was before Nostra Aetate. Now, you just heard a really masterful presentation about where the evangelical community is, the Christian right. So I'm not going to talk too much about them. I will talk a lot about the Roman Catholic Church and also about liberal or mainstream Protestant churches. That's another thing that Jews need to understand very clearly. Too many Jews think there's the Christian world out there. What is the Christian opinion? What does the Christian community think? Right? The truth is that there is no Christian community, per se. The most simplistic analysis would be that there are three clusters of Christian theologies or Christian opinions regarding Jews and Judaism. Right? You have the Christian right on the one hand. You have the Roman Catholic Church on the other hand, which is also quite diverse, right? But it's a world unto itself. And then you have what's known in America, at least, as the mainline Protestant churches, the liberal churches. And these are three separate worlds, theologically and politically. And Jews need to understand this because Christians come from different places when you talk to them, either about the status of Judaism or the status about the political issues that Jews care deeply about. If you think it's hard to get a Reform rabbi and an Orthodox rabbi in the same room, try getting an evangelical minister and a Presbyterian minister in the same room. They are theological and political enemies, and they're really like almost separate religions. Now, throughout the Middle Ages into modernity, there's no question that the greatest enemy of the Jewish people was official Christianity, whether it be the Catholic Church or Martin Luther after the Reformation. Because, as Dr. Berger mentioned earlier, traditional Christian theology taught that Christianity had superseded Judaism, and the Jewish Brit with God. But Jews refused to disappear. You see, this is something that was just mentioned. The most logical people to recognize that Jesus was the Messiah was the Jewish people. And yet they didn't do it. And they refused to disappear. That's what the logical result of the truth of Christianity should have been. But Jews stayed around, and they rejected Jesus. And therefore, Christian theologians were faced with a great dilemma. How do you explain the fact that Jews continued to reject Jesus and persisted in their stubbornness? And the doctrine emerged from Augustine that Jews, by their very continued existence, constituted negative witnesses. Their humiliation, their poverty, and their subjugation by Christian constituted, whether they liked it or not, a witness to the truth of Christianity. Right. So, and that they were a witness to what happens to those who reject Jesus. So the humiliation of Jews, right, almost became a kind of religious ideal for Christianity, because it showed all the world what happens to those who reject Jesus. Throughout the years, Christians tried to convert us. At times, they tried to kill us. And when they couldn't do any of the above, they vomited us out from Spain, from Italy, from Christian society. And this behavior and this traditional teaching became known as the teaching of contempt. And it prepared the groundwork for the alienation of the Jew and Hitler's diabolical plans to dehumanize the Jew and ultimately to exterminate Jews. And therefore, when you look at, and Christians understood this after the Shoah. After World War II, they looked around at the disaster, the moral disaster and the social disaster and the religious disaster, right? And they understood that something had to change in Christianity, because they played a role, a very great role, in allowing this to happen. And they achieved a transformation, many of them. And it is most clear within the Catholic Church. So I'll talk a lot about the Catholic Church. I talked about three different worlds of Christianity. The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is still the elephant in the room. It's still the biggest, the most influential, on a social level and also on a theological level. So when the Catholic Church speaks, right, Protestants listen also. And the transformation in the Catholic Church has had an enormous influence on other sectors in Christianity. And it's hard to underestimate the difficulty and the impressive character of changing fundamental doctrine. I mean, just think about it. If I or any Jew would want to change one word in Eleinu, in the Siddur, right? What would happen in the Orthodox community, right? And here you have the Roman Catholic Church changing not only their Siddur, but fundamental teachings that have been tradition for close to 2,000 years about how to understand Jews, how to treat Jews, and how to and understand Judaism. Now, of course, not all Christians have come to accept this, right? And internalize this. I talked about, and there's a certain gamut. I'm sure there are still, you know, very ultra-Orthodox Catholics in Italy, even in America, some of them wear red kippot, you know, who still pine for the days of pre-Vatican II. They still want to believe the old-time religion. Right? But they don't speak for the church, by and large. The Pope speaks for the church and the heads of the Protestant churches. And therefore, this change, even though it might be official on paper, takes time for it to seep down into the community. Again, we can understand this from our own community. But the six R's, right, the revolution of the six R's, should change the whole dynamic of Jewish-Christian relations and at least give us an opportunity to build a better future together. so that if Christianity can drop its traditional triumphalist posture toward Jews, that is, that Christianity is true, therefore Judaism is false. Right? That's known as supersessionism, that Christianity superseded Judaism. If it can drop this supersessionism, and if it can stop demeaning Judaism and trying to convert Jews, then there's at least a possibility for cooperation and alliance in the future. Right? But much is also required of Jews. Right? For Jews to begin to understand Christianity differently, right, is a great both psychological, even I would say more psychological than theological issue. We have to somehow liberate ourselves, and this is difficult, have to liberate ourselves from the image of being an eternal victim, right? And begin to think in terms of partnership, or at least cooperation, with that world and those churches, right, who have been our worst enemies over time. Right? That's difficult to do. My teacher in Jerusalem, David Hartman, once said that Christianity humiliated his Zayde. Right? They spit on his Zayde. Yeah. They humiliated his ancestors. Right? They even killed his ancestors. But we can't bring our ancestors back. The issue for rational Jews today is not what happened to our ancestors. The issue is how do we build a future or a world that will be safe for our grandchildren, because there's nothing we can do about the past. So that's the task. How do we look to the future rather than the past? Now, I believe, and we can put it this way, can we go from an ethic of suspicion toward the Gentiles and toward the Christian to an ethic of cooperation and greater understanding? Now, I believe that, as I tried to say this morning, there's no hard halachic obstacle to viewing Christians and Christianity positively. There are valid sources in our halachic tradition, in our Torah tradition, which can look upon Christians and Christianity in a positive light. So there's no halachic bar to that. Okay? And I believe there are powerful reasons, both political and cultural, right, why this is important for Jews to do, and why this further Jewish interests, even though it's very emotionally difficult for us to do this. And I'm going to talk a little bit about both the politics of the issue as well as the spiritual concerns. First of all, in the politics of the issue, Jews love to do surveys. Right? And one of the things we like to survey is whether we are dying as a people. Right, you know. So, what do Jews do? Are we dying as a people? We'll have a convention. We'll have a vote. Are Jews going to survive or not survive? We're always worried about our own survival. We are the eternally dying people. Okay, but it is true demographically in America, in North America, that Jews are shrinking as a percentage of the larger population. When I was growing up, long time ago, Jews constituted about 4% of the American population. Right. Today, it's less than 2% of the American population, and the projections, according to some demographers, is that in the year 2050 will be maybe 1% of the American population. I assume that similar phenomena exist in Canada. Right? Now, what that means is that Jews statistically are going to be less of the general population, and therefore our political clout is likely to diminish along with our numbers. Right? And therefore, the name of the game in terms of Jewish politics will be to what extent we can forge effective coalitions with non-Jews, right? Because only through effective coalitions will we represent a certain power base that will get the attention of policymakers and politicians. So that's one. And therefore, we have to look around for friends on particular issues. And I would say very particularly on the issue of Israel, because that is a central issue for us. Israel today is the public face of the Jewish people. When someone attacks Israel, not a policy, this policy of this Israeli government or that policy of that Israeli government, when someone attacks the fundamental right for Israel to exist. When someone is an anti-Zionist, that translates to anti-Semitism. Because today, the Jewish people is represented by the state of Israel. And therefore, Israel becomes very, very central to us. So that's one reason. The second reason is that we have a new enemy in the 21st century. Christianity, for a variety of reasons, the Catholic Church is not the power that it was 200 years ago. It's not even the power that it was when Herzl went to see the Pope. Okay. Christianity today does not have the clout that it had in the past. Right? And therefore, even if it wanted to be our enemy, it wouldn't be able to do the harm that it's done in the past. Right? Theologically, there's this notion that there's no reason for Judaism to be false when Christianity is true. And there's no reason to convert Jews. In fact, kind of an interesting sidelight about these six R's. One of the six R's was a rethinking about converting Jews. So 2 years ago, there was a group of Catholic theologians who published a paper under the sanction of the Bishops' Conference in the United States, saying that it is no longer theologically acceptable to attempt to convert Jews to the Catholic Church. It's off the agenda. And Jews thought this was a very benevolent, kind gesture. It was a major breakthrough. Not everybody agreed with it, by the way. Okay, they got a lot of flack for it, but it's certainly Catholics are thinking about just dropping the whole notion of converting Jews. And today, there is no office in the Roman Catholic Church that has its mission to convert Jews, unlike the evangelicals. Okay, even they may think in theory it should be done, but in practice, lemasse, right? The facts on the ground is that there is no organized group whose mission it is to convert the Jews. So these Catholics, these progressive Catholics, issued this paper and they said, not only is it wrong in practice, it's wrong in theory. Catholics shouldn't be converting Jews. At which point the Southern Baptists said, this is the most anti-Semitic document that's ever come out. Right? Because who are the Catholics to deny Jews the promise of salvation? It's anti-Semitic, right? So this speaks to the complexity of the whole dealing with Christian evangelicals. But in fact, the real threat of conversion doesn't come from the Catholic Church today. How many Jews do you know who are actually converted to the Roman Catholic Church? I don't know any. The real enemy of the Jewish people in the 21st century is radical Islam. Okay. The real enemy of sense of religious freedom and pluralism and Jews to live with dignity and independence and authenticity is radical Islam, extreme Islam. And the Roman Catholic Church has the same enemy. And Christians in the Middle East have the same enemy. Right? And the West has the same enemy. If there is a clash of civilization, it's a clash between radical Islam, intolerant Islam on the one hand. Now, I'm very careful about what I say. I'm not talking about Islam, all forms of Islam. I'm talking about the aggressive, intolerant, radical Islam. The clash of civilization is between that school and those powers. Right? And Christians and Jews in the West and in the Middle East. Okay. Now, just think about it. And when I go to the Vatican and I speak to officials in the Vatican, we close the door, and that's what they're worried about. They're worried about Islam taking over Europe, and they're worried about the fate of Christians in the Middle East. You know, and when I go to Israel and I go to Jerusalem and I go to the think tanks, what are they concerned about? They're concerned about the Muslims trying to destroy the state of Israel. Right? It's the same enemy. So for tactical reasons, we have a lot in common with the Roman Catholic Church for sure, and even Christians in the Middle East. Now, this is a little complicated, but think about the conflict in the Middle East. It's been going on actively since 1948, 60 years approximately, 50 years, 60 years. It's remarkable, right? Why can't there be a resolution of the conflict? 60 years, and there's no end in sight, folks. I wish it were otherwise, but there's no end in sight. The reason is because it's not a normal conflict. It's not a territorial dispute. the dispute with the Palestinian people, Palestinians, may in fact be only a territorial dispute. That's a very classic dispute in the history of humanity. Two peoples fighting over the same bit of land. Ultimately, they work it out. Right? So that's a rational dispute that's open to kind of rational, pragmatic resolution. That I understand the Palestinians in that regard. What I don't understand, right, is why the president of Iran, right, or imam in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, or in Cairo, right, or in Damascus, you know, refuses to accept the state of Israel in the Middle East. Think about it. Why should an imam in Mecca care about who has official responsibility to collect the garbage in Tel Aviv? Right? That's the nature of the dispute, right? And the answer is because traditional Islamic, or at least Arab Muslim political theory, teaches that that sphere of the world known as Dar al-Islam, right, can only have one authority, Muslim authority. Right? There is no, if you read Bernard Lewis, for instance, and the other people who used to be called Orientalists before it became a four-letter word, and they talk about the history of Arab thinking, right, they say that there's two ideas that never crept in to Arab political thinking. One is the equality of women with men, and the other is the equality of non-Muslims with Muslims. Right? And therefore, non-Muslims, namely Jews and Christians, could stay in the Arab world. They had a place in the Arab world. And historically, Jews usually had it better under Muslims than they did under Christians. Right? But Jews, neither Jews nor Christians were ever equal to Muslims in law or in social value. Right? Jews and Christians had a special protected status. They were known as dhimmis. Dhimmis are a status of non-Muslims who are allowed to live in Muslim under Muslim authority through the benevolence of the Muslim authority, had to have to pay a special tax, right? And because of the benevolence, or that literally the tolerance of Muslim authorities, right, they're allowed to live as second-class residents, not citizens but residents. And so Jews and Christians, you know, had the same inferior status traditionally. There never was a concept of Jews or Christians living as equals to Muslims in the Dar al-Islam, nor was there the concept of there being an official authority, independent authority, free of any subordination to Muslim authority. Now, after the Shoah, the Jews said to themselves, no longer will we place the fate of Jews or the Jewish future in the hands of Goyim. I mean, that sounds kind of crude, but that's basically what happened. No longer can we afford to live defenseless and under the benevolence of non-Jews. The only thing that will help us in the long run is our own country, with our own sovereignty, with our own army. Right? In other words, national independence. Right? And they demanded their own country, and that's what Israel is. Israel, above all, is staking out the possibility of a Jewish independence in the world of Islam. And that is a threat to traditional Arab thinking. That's why the imam in Mecca can't tolerate the idea that Jews have control over Tel Aviv. Right? Because Jews shouldn't have control over Tel Aviv or any part of the Arab world. They should always live subordinated to Muslim authority. So, but Jews have, and therefore there's this unrelenting opposition to the existence of the state of Israel. It doesn't have to do with where the borders are. It has to do with the fact that there are borders. It's not about 1967, it's about 1948. Now, Jews at least have the ability to defend themselves under this arrangement, and thank God Israel is a strong country and can defend itself after a lot of blood is spilled. But Christians in the Middle East have no country, have no government. Right? They're minorities who are completely subordinated and subjugated by Muslim authorities. Right? They live a very, they're like what my great-grandfather was living under the Tsar. Right? God forbid that they should. They were unprotected, enormously vulnerable, and whenever the Tsar wanted to persecute them, he did. And that's exactly the status of Christians in the Middle East. They're unprotected minorities. Right? And they can live well in periods of tolerance, but in the period like today of rising Islamic identity and intolerance, they are enormously vulnerable and are being persecuted and oppressed and being driven out of the Middle East. Christians, most Christians who have the means to do so, are emigrating from the Middle East. If you look at the population statistics, the absolute numbers of Christians in every country in the Middle East between 1948 and today has decreased. There's one exception. Israel. Because Israel is a different political arrangement. Christians have equal rights, at least on paper. There are some serious problems in Israel. There is discrimination in Israel, but at least constitutionally on paper, Christians have equal rights to Jews, right? And they are protected by law. Okay. And therefore, the number of Christians in Israel between 1948 and today has gone up somewhere between 350 and 375%. There were approximately 40,000 Christians in Israel at the establishment of the state in 1948. Today, the numbers vary, but they're somewhere between 140 and 160,000. 350% increase, and every other place in the Middle East, they've decreased. So what does that tell you? That tells you that Christians are suffering under Muslim rule. And the reason is that there is no notion of legal pluralism in the Arab world. Sometimes Christians have it good, but they are never equal. Right? And today, they are being oppressed. Now, what this means is that there should be a strategic alliance between Christians and Jews for the interests of Christians in the Middle East. The status and the welfare of Christians in the Middle East will only be strengthened if Israel is strengthened. Because when Israel is accepted, when Israel is strong, right, it means that there's a place in the Middle East for non-Muslims to live with dignity and equality. If Zionism, God forbid, or Israel, God forbid, you know, becomes weak and Israel goes under, what that means is that there's no place, there's no equal place for Jews or for Christians in the Middle East. And therefore, strategically thinking Christians and Jews ought to understand that they're fighting the same enemy. And they're, in fact, fighting the same enemy in the West. I would say what you have in this class of civilizations is a sense of pluralistic philosophy in which Jews and Christians and any minority can live together in peace and equality. Right? You have that vision of pluralism and Western democracy bumping up against a radical Islamic monism in which there's only one place or only one people which can have authority and dignity and protection. And all other groups of people, all other religions, have an inferior status and are enormously vulnerable. That's the class of civilizations, and Jews and Christians are on the same side in that clash. Now, the Catholic Church understands this very, very well. And Dr. Berger was correct this morning in saying that the Church, by and large, tries not to get involved in the political rhetoric and the propaganda regarding Israel. The Church tries to stay neutral. They're not anti-Israel. But I can tell you that I was at a meeting at the consulate in New York perhaps 6 months ago in which the highest ranking Israeli official after the ambassador to America, he said that the current Pope, Pope Benedict XVI, is the friendliest Pope in history in terms of relating to the state of Israel, not of the Jews, because I think John Paul was the best of the Pope relating to Jews and Judaism, but with regard to the attitude toward the state of Israel, the present pope, right, is the best in the history of Jewish-Catholic relations. Now, this brings us to the Protestants, the mainline Protestants. When I say the mainline Protestants in America, if this were an American audience, I would say the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, United Church of Christ, Disciples of Christ, and the Lutherans. Right? Now that I'm in Canada, I have to add the United Church of Canada. Okay. Now, there's something very disturbing going on in these churches, and you probably are aware of it. In America, Jews have two Bibles. Okay, one is the Tanakh, and the other is the New York Times. Okay, so I mean, we read the New York Times religiously, everywhere, most Jews. Many Jews. My chevra does. So if you open up the New York Times on Sunday, right opposite the editorial page, you'll see a full-page ad, a scurrilous ad, by something called the Coalition for National Interest, that talks about how the Israelis, and you can translate that as Jews, they mean the Jews, right, are destroying Bethlehem so that Christians cannot really observe Christmas in the place where it all started, in Bethlehem, because of the wall and because of oppression and colonialism and occupation and all that other political rhetoric. Okay. And I've spent the last 2 years of my professional life fighting against the mainline Protestant churches who are embarked on a program enormously hostile to Israel, enormously pro-Palestinian, and sometimes viciously anti-Zionist. Right? So you have a great paradox here. These mainline churches have Christians in the Middle East, living in Lebanon, in Jordan, in the Palestinian territories and in the state of Israel. Right? These communities, except for the ones in Israel, are imperiled. They're being oppressed and persecuted by the Muslim authorities, and in particular the Palestinian Authority. I'll give you one set of statistics. Bethlehem, right, was controlled by the Israeli government until 1995. Right? And under the Oslo Accords, the Israeli government ceded control of Bethlehem to Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority. In 1995, Bethlehem was 80% Christian. It had a Christian mayor. It had a predominantly Christian municipal council. Today, what is it, 11 years later, you go to Bethlehem, it is 12% Christian. Christians have been stripped of all municipal power. Christians are leaving in droves. They're selling their businesses. Right? And it's not because of the Israeli occupation or the wall. Right? Because immediately after 1995, in the good years, right, before the Intifada, the second Intifada, before the security barrier, Christians started leaving because they understood that they couldn't live in dignity with any degree of security under Muslim rule. And it's only gotten worse. Now Hamas runs the Palestinian Authority. Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood. Christians need to think seriously about what their fate will be living under a government with the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. Right? So you have this situation where Christians are being persecuted by the Muslims, and they're blaming the Jews or the Israelis, right? And if you go and you look at the position of many of the national churches, see, here's the complexity. The evangelicals maybe want to convert us. They may love Jews, but they don't respect Judaism. And that's a very fine line to walk, and you heard a wonderful presentation that indicated that. On the other hand, the liberal churches respect Judaism. They all sign up for this. They understand Judaism as a living faith and an independent faith, right? But they're enormously hostile to the state of Israel. Even though they say that Israel has a right to exist, they never once lift a finger to help Israel defend its right to exist. Right? So what's going on here? It sounds like they're committing suicide. And the answer is that there's a small focus group of radical left, political leftist ideologues in these churches, right, who have bought the line that the Israelis are colonialists, that the root of all evil in the Middle East comes from the Israelis, and if you just eliminated occupation and then down the line eliminated Israel, Jews and Christians and Arabs would all live together just very, very nicely, right? And Israel is an apartheid state. You see that in the documents of the churches. Israel is an apartheid state. And just as the apartheid state of South Africa had to be dismantled, the Zionist colonial state has to be dismantled. Now, why are they doing this? This is contrary to the interests of the Christians living in Bethlehem, and Ramallah used to be a Christian city. And the answer is that they're dhimmis. They're like, my great-grandfather was under the Tsar. They understand that, at least the local Palestinian Christian leaders understand that if they criticize the Muslims, right, they get their heads chopped off. Right? And they come to America and they tell the head bishop of the Episcopal Church and the Methodist Church and the Lutheran Church and the Presbyterian Church in particular that it's Israel that's the problem. And this plays into the propaganda of the leftists, of the radical leftists. And sometimes it's just naked anti-Zionism, and sometimes it's vicious, it is anti-Semitic. It is anti-Semitic. Now, it's also very important for Jews to understand that even within these churches, this is a very small group. I can't speak for the Canadian Protestant community, but I do have somewhat of an understanding of the American Protestant, mainline Protestant community. All the polls in America taken in the last 20 years indicate that the sympathy for Israel over the Palestinians is somewhere between 3-1 and 4-1. Americans like Israel. Why? Because they see Israel as a Western democracy trying to fight off radicals and intolerant Muslims, right? They identify, and after 9/11, the ratio went from about 3.5-1 to about 3.8 or 3.9-1. After the election of Hamas, it's now 4-1, right? And many of these Americans who are sympathetic to Israel pray on Sunday in the Episcopal Church, in the Presbyterian Church, in the Methodist Church. The rank and file, right, what they call in the Vatican the Balabatim, are pro-Israel, because Americans are pro-Israel, and they reflect it. Not just the evangelicals are pro-Israel. The rank and file, even within these mainline churches, are sympathetic to Israel. And I see this. I go out and I speak in churches around the country, right? And I'm ready for a serious ideological conflict, and I basically explain the situation to them, and they all are quite sympathetic to Israel. So the answer is that there's a small group of ideologues that have kind of hijacked these churches with their own agenda that don't reflect the position of the real Christians or the majority of the Christians in these churches. And therefore, given the fact that the strategic interests of the Christians in the Middle East, right, are for a strong Israel, because Israel represents pluralism and democracy and protection of minorities, given the fact that Christian interests and Jewish interests, right, are similar, they're fighting the same ideological and physical enemy, there should be a strategic alliance. There should be a meeting of the minds in this general clash of civilization, and specifically in the issues pertaining to the Middle East. Now, this is easier said than done, because, as I said before, there are a small group of viciously anti-Israel ideologues who have kind of hijacked these American mainline churches, and also the United Church of Canada recently voted, I think, right, to have a boycott, either a boycott or a divestment. You know, it's not because the rank and file of the United Church of Canada believe this. It's because the political activists believe it. And therefore, there's a lot of work to do between Jews and Christians. And I believe, ultimately, you know, that alliance can be forged. The Catholic Church, for sure, is vitally interested in fighting off this threat of intolerant, monistic Islam. Now, those are the political considerations. Let me just talk briefly, and I'll close with this, about cultural and religious considerations. As I said before, for 1900 years, the prevailing assumption was, if for Christianity to be true, Judaism had to be false. Right? And for Jews to have any sense of validity, they had to convert to Christianity. But with the transformation or the revolution of the six R's, that's no longer the case. So I mentioned this morning I teach at a Catholic university. And I have to tell you, again, to use a Vatican term, it's really a machaya. You know, and I'll tell you why. Because these are deeply religious people. And they understand that their religious integrity doesn't depend upon me converting into their church. Now, I'm not saying all Catholics are like this, but this is the official position of the Roman Catholic Church today. There are some still Haredim in the church who want to go back to the old days. But that's not the church by and large. And therefore, I can, when I speak, they understand what it is for a religious person to live in a secular world and the struggles that, that a religious person has with the secular world. Because they have the same struggles. How do you live in a secular culture saturated with materialism and hedonism and immorality and retain your religious identity? How do you speak with any kind of serious conviction to the outside world, right, about Torah Min HaShemayim, about believing that somehow God can communicate with you, about having a text that you consider to be a sacred text that you can't play around with at will? Liberal Jews, many liberal Jews don't understand that. You know who understands it? When you leave your little, I live in a little shtetl, you know, like a little ghetto. It wasn't that way when I moved there, but it is that way now. It's called Teaneck, New Jersey. Okay? So and people ask me, why do you deal with Christians? And I said, let me ask you a question. When you leave the shul, who can you talk to about seriously? Who can you talk to with seriously about Torah Min HaShemayim? Who can you talk to who understand the notion that you have a certain commitment to God that sometimes runs in contradictory directions from the way modern culture is going? You know who you can talk to other than other Orthodox Jews? From Catholics. They get it. They understand it because they're struggling with the same issue of how do you live a religious life in a secular world. A year and a half ago, there was really an unbelievable event. Some say it was a bracha, some say it was a klola. You decide. But there was a group of 16 Roman Catholic cardinals came to Yeshiva University. Right? 16 Roman Catholic, and they came with the whole uniform. You know, some with red capes, crucifixes around their neck, the whole thing, right? I was there. I was asked to represent YU along with Dr. Lam and President Joel. And we had like a little strategy meeting. What are we going to say to these people? You know, so I suggested to Dr. Lam, I said, you know why they're coming here? Because they want to see how Jews retain their religious culture in a secular world. They have the same problem that we do, and they want to see if we can somehow give them some clues on how to do it. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the religious problems, the religious dilemmas that people with religious commitments have living in a larger world. Because the Catholics believe that they're losing in Europe. Right? So we have the same, very, very similar set of spiritual struggles to work with. And therefore, if in fact Christians of any variety set as a ground rule that in our relationship and in our discussions, they stop trying to convert us, that's off the table. And Catholics are willing to abide by those rules. Evangelicals evidently are not. Mainline Protestants are different because they don't want to talk about spiritual troubles. They want to talk about the social gospel and justice and the Middle East. Okay, but I'm talking about the one who want to talk about theology. And that's why Dr. Berger and I have had this running debate about whether Jews should talk theology to Christians. I think that they should because it's in our not only political interests, it's in our spiritual interests. We have something to learn from them and they have something to learn from us because the fact is the way modern culture has developed, right, we are very much on the same side as they are. We're fighting the same sources of materialism and hedonism and utilitarianism. You open up a document from the Vatican about human life, and the first thing that it says is something that should come out of every Sefer Halacha, and that is every human being is created in the image of God and therefore has intrinsic sanctity, and you can't play with human life. You can't sacrifice an innocent human life. Right? You can't give up on a human life. That's deeply Jewish. They got that from us. And they are the ones who are Orthodox Jews or I would say traditional Jews and Roman Catholics are the only people who talk that language today. Right? And therefore, we should be talking to them on those types of issues. So the whole world is turned upside down. The 21st century has a whole new political alignment. Right? The people who are enemies in the past are not our enemies in the 21st century. It's not so rosy. We have to be careful. There are serious issues to be involved. Right? But I'm saying in broad strokes, we have a lot of strategic common interests, both on a political level and on a spiritual level, right, with serious Christians. Now, can Jews rewire their brains, you know, and somehow say, I know they killed my Zaidi, but the issue is my grandchildren, not my grandfather, right? So what's in our interest, both political interests and spiritual interests? Can we make that psychological transition? It's not easy to do, right? But I think in terms of rational self-interest, we ought to make that. We have a lot to learn from it. And it will give us some hope that the 21st century will be better on the Jewish people, right, than the past. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take just one or two questions, if there are any, and then we'll call it an afternoon. We have to get people who haven't asked.
I just have a question for you. I'm concerned that you're a bit too sanguine about the mainstream Protestant churches. I mean, my take on it would be that the Protestant churches essentially don't have a religion. Their religion has become liberal politics. And liberal politics has a David and Goliath version of the Middle East conflict in which we are Goliath. And that is part of their religion. And what concerns me is that the one thing they've retained from traditional Christianity is essentially anti-Semitism, because it's really hard to understand the obsessive one-sidedness of their analysis of the conflict other than anti-Semitism. Just layer that on to Jimmy Carter, and I don't know where he belongs, whether he's a Christian fundamentalist, but there's no other explanation. When Jimmy Carter says in response to a question that the reason we have a conflict in the Middle East is because Israel has failed to withdraw, ignoring the other half of all the UN resolutions, which requires a quid pro quo, there's no other explanation for that. So I guess I find it very difficult to accept that there's just a small coterie of people who have hijacked these churches. I think they're churches looking for a religion. They found left-wing politics as their religion. And the one legacy they have is anti-Semitism from the old religion.
So two reactions. And I thought a lot about this because I said, you know, my kishkas, 2 years of my professional life have been spent with these people. And I think we've had enormous success. It's not me personally, but the Jewish community acting smartly and like B'nai Adam with these people have had success. Two reactions. Number one, I try not to call people anti-Semitic. And here's why, because I think it's against our own interest to do so. Usually when you call someone anti-Semitic, what you're really saying is you no longer have responsibility to deal with these people. It's a sign of abdication of responsibility. It's saying these people are so hopelessly biased that there's not any value to my continuing to have a relationship with them or talk with them or influence them or convince them. Right? It's, in other words, it's a cop-out. Therefore, I try not to adopt that position. My position is to engage them. Now, some of them are what I would call hopelessly religious. That is, you're not going to convince them, you know, that the Israelis, to give the Israelis a fair shake, because they're so wedded to this, I would say it's loopy leftist political vision of the world. You're not going to convince them. The ball game is convincing the balabatim, the people in the pews, and the administrators of the churches. You see, there's three groups within these churches. There are the ideologues, there's the chief minister, who basically has an administrative job trying to keep all these churches together. And they're not primarily ideological people. They're people who have an enormous administrative burden trying to hold, you know, the national church together. And they go in whichever direction the politics pushes most forcefully. Right? So those are two groups. And then you have the people in the pews, what's known as the pew level. The pew level in America is not anti-Semitic. They are not even anti-Israel. Right? Some of the Episcopal Church voted passed a resolution in July of 2004 to divest from companies doing business that support the occupation, quote unquote. It was Caterpillar Tractor. Caterpillar Tractor became the antichrist of the whole movement, right? And then some other high-tech companies like Motorola, et cetera. When I go around and speak to Presbyterians around the country, many of them don't even know that the resolution was passed. And another large segment doesn't agree with the resolution. That's what I meant when I said that a small group of people hijacked the national agenda. Right? So you're correct. We're not going to convince the ideologues. But the ball game is to convince the rank and file. And in fact, we did that. So Dr. Berger mentioned that I was in Israel with 13 high-level Presbyterians. We showed them the reality. Forget about the propaganda. We showed them reality. We went to the Palestinian territories. We went to talk to Israelis. And they saw that it's a very complicated situation. And the Israelis are not the ones at fault here, or at least not primarily at fault. The Israelis have made a lot of mistakes. And they came back, and they lobbied inside the Presbyterian Church, and they rescinded the divestment resolution. Because they understand, you know, what the opposition is all about. The Palestinian Authority executes Muslims who convert to Christianity. It's a capital offense, right? There's no tolerance. There's no pluralism. There's no live and let live. You know, so they have to understand the brutal politics of the Middle East. And they can understand it. And Jews have to make a special effort not to call them anti-Semitic and disengage from them. We need to re-engage with them because I think they're fundamentally fair people who will listen to reason. And they understand the American ethos. And the American ethos is much closer to the Israeli ethos than it is to the Palestinian ethos. Okay, so that's where the good fight is.
Okay, last question.
You spoke a bunch about the monism that pervades radical Islam and the desire to, you know, reimpose religious and cultural homogeneity throughout the Middle East, including Israel. I'm wondering to what extent you see certain parallelism to the rise of fundamentalist Christian thought and its political expressions in the U.S., recognizing that, of course, you know, they're on different magnitude and have different theological backgrounds, but to what extent you think that may, in the future, raise some of the same issues for different minorities living in the U.S.?
Okay, so I'll answer that on two levels. Number one, there's a tactical level, and number two, there's a kind of philosophical, principled level. There's a fundamental difference, even if you have really extremist visions like A. Foxman has about the evangelicals. You know, I don't subscribe to that issue that they're really trying to baptize America. But even if you did, there's a fundamental difference between that kind of taking over and the taking over of radical Islam. Radical Islam is committed to taking over by means of violence and killing and holy war. And holy war does not simply mean spiritual struggle. Holy war means military conflict. Right? So that's one kind of taking over. That's why there's a clash of civilizations that's urgent and immediate. Right? So even if you have the worst fears about the evangelicals, which I do not, the threat from Islam is much more real and much more physical. Right? They're after my bodies. And they're after the bodies of my grandchildren and my son and daughter-in-law who live in the state of Israel. And when they get done with them, they'll come here for us. That's where it leads. So there's a big difference on a tactical level. On a principled level, it may be that the evangelicals really do want to, you know, baptize America and make us. I don't happen to believe that. I don't see that in the statistics or in the expressions. Some of them do. Now, again, we can't fall into the trap of believing that an evangelical is an evangelical is an evangelical. There's a gamut of people. There are very serious, nuanced, sensitive, rational evangelicals, right, who don't subscribe to this, you know, extreme vision of the end of days and all of this, right? They're rational. They want to work in the world as we know it. And I think there's a lot for the Jewish community to talk about with these people. It's, again, it's another issue of us trying to get over our emotional proclivities, because we're very nervous with evangelicals, and legitimately so. I'm very nervous with evangelicals, you know, for a number of reasons, because of the history of anti-Semitism, one, two, because they do have this vision of, you know, Christianity ultimately winning out, and either I will convert or I will burn in the long run. And secondly, because on most domestic political issues, they happen to take positions that are contrary to the liberal agenda of the Jewish community. I assume it's similar in Canada to that situation in America. But, you know, the kind of real religion of the American Jewish community is domestic liberalism, i.e. separation of church and state, pro-choice, keeping religion out of the public square. Right? And here's the complexity of it. The mainline Protestants march in lockstep, or we march in lockstep with the mainline Protestants on these domestic issues. Right? And the evangelicals are the opposite. They want prayer in the school. They want religion in the public place. They want limitations on abortion. Right, so the domestic agenda is contrary to the majority of the Jewish community. And yet when it comes to Israel, it's the opposite. The mainline Protestants are the enemies, right? At least the official national positions of these churches, not the people in the pews. Right? And the evangelicals are the greatest allies in political and diplomatic terms that Israel has. I mean, I talked about the Baptists, who said that if Catholics don't want to convert Jews, it's anti-Semitic. Right? But the flip side of that, I don't know how many of you are aware there's an organization, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. The president is an Orthodox rabbi named Yechiel Eckstein. Right? So I went to see his office in Chicago. They raise $40 million a year for Israel. They raise money for Russian Jews to make aliyah to Israel. I went into the office, and the office, every inch of wall space is filled with beautiful photographs. You know what the photographs are? Of Ethiopian Jews having a mass bar mitzvah. Right? Of soup kitchens that are sponsored by the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews to feed poor Jews, to give food to poor Jews all over the state of Israel. I mean, so whatever their motivations are, these are acts of chesed. How can you not appreciate something like that? So it's very complicated. It really is. I think the Jewish community has to explore more deeply how we can have positive relationships with the Christian right, right, without, to use the somewhat crude idiom, getting into bed with them. That is, we can't simply agree with them on all their issues, because then in the end we may get sucked into this conversion thing. But we should appreciate them for the good that they do to the state of Israel and Am Yisrael. So we need to kind of rethink that. This is part of the challenge of Jewish-Christian relations in the 21st century.
Thank you very much. We're at 3:30. Dr. Korn has a 5:15 flight that he has to catch.